downshifting, isn't it? To just sit quietly together. I was thinking we always used to have little inexpensive Japanese cars, you know, really simple cars, manual transmissions, and when you were cruising down the freeway in fifth gear, you knew it, you know what I mean? You could really hear the engine going. Did you have a car like that? Yeah. Now we have a car, you can't even tell what it's doing, it just goes. But and I was thinking, you know, that's kind of how we are a lot of the time in our life, right? And when you're cruising down the freeway all day on the road trip or something, you get used to it, you know, you get used to it. So maybe these structures, you know, that we inherited are really just support and just... And then where are we? You know, what is this vehicle? So I have a short subject for you first. Moody cow meditates. My name is Moody Cow. It used to be Peter, but now it's Moody Cow. It all started one stupid, rotten day when everything went wrong. First, I had a bad dream. Hopefully you'll be able to see, okay? There's Moody Cow. A very bad dream, which involved a giant three-eyed alien. You can substitute, you know, career anxiety or whatever you want. What a rotten way to wake up. I wanted to find my mind and tell her about the giant three-eyed alien, but I couldn't find her anywhere. In the picture, he's saying, Mom! And so I admit I was in a bad mood to begin with, and then I couldn't find my skateboard. Turns out my sister had borrowed it. Daisy, stop drawing on my skateboard. Okay, maybe I overreacted when I pulled her tail, but it was a brand new skateboard. And so then Daisy had to get me back by tripping me on the stairs. What a monster. That made me mad, so mad that I cut her doll's hair off on purpose. And of course, I got in trouble for that, which made me miss the bus. I had to ride my bike all the way to school in the snow. That made me really mad. On the way home from school, I hit a snowbank and I scraped my knee and there was blood everywhere. And the rest of the way, I couldn't stop thinking about how my rotten day was really Daisy's fault. She put me in a bad mood by drawing on my new skateboard. Or maybe it was the giant three-eyed alien's fault for giving me bad dreams. Whatever. I was so mad I couldn't see straight. And then when I turned into our driveway, I crashed into my dad's truck. Ow! You can understand with a bloody knee and a banged up nose, I was madder than ever. Super mad. There's smoke coming out of his ears now. So then I did something crazy. I picked up my baseball and I threw it right through the window on purpose. Unfortunately, my mom saw the whole thing. What on earth do you think you're doing? She yelled. Have you lost your mind? She came outside and took one look at my super mad, rotten day face. I guess she did feel sorry for me. Aw, are you a little moody cow? And of course, my sister Daisy heard that. In the background, she and her friends are yelling, Moody Cow, Moody Cow, Moody, Moody, Moody Cow. She started shouting, Moody Cow, Peter is a Moody Cow. The next thing I knew, all the kids in the neighborhood joined in. "We need grandfather," Mom said, and picked up the phone. Pretty soon, my grandfather was sitting in the sunroom on a meditation cushion. I got to sit on one, too. "I hear they're calling you Moody Cow," grandfather said and smiled. I couldn't help smiling back a little. I guess Moody Cow was a kind of a funny name. So here's Grandfather Cow. "See this?" he asked as he pointed to a jar of water. "This is your mind. And these," he held out a little dish of sparkles, "are your angry thoughts." "That," I said, "is a jar of water. Those are Daisy's fairy dust sparkles. Come on, Moody Cow, work with me here. Now, what we're going to do is put a pinch of sparkles into the water for every angry thought that you have. Then we're going to sit here until they all settle down to the bottom. By the time the water is clear again, your anger will have settled down too." "That won't work," I said. "Let's just see," he said. So I took a pinch of sparkles and dropped it in the water. "What angry thought is that?" grandfather asked. "That's the three-eyed alien that tried to gobble me last night." "Oh, I see. Rotten way to start the day. Okay, what else?" I took another pinch for the next angry thought. "This is me having to clean the toilet for a whole month for breaking the window. I hate cleaning the toilet." "Me too. What else?" I put in one more pinch of sparkles and said, "This is Daisy drawing on my brand new skateboard with a marker." "Oh dear. Did she do that?" Grandfather sighed. "Okay. What else?" "This pinch is for when I miss the bus and I ride my bike to school in the snow." "You can ride a bike through snow?" grandfather asked. "I have good tires. Anything else?" "On my way home, I scraped my knee. I was so mad I crashed into Dad's truck. I think I broke my nose." "Ouch," grandfather said. "That must have hurt." "It did. Then I picked up my baseball and threw it through the window on purpose." "Oh, maybe you should do a double pinch for that one." "I guess you did have a Moody Cow day." "I sure did." "Is that all?" grandfather asked. "Yeah, but it's a lot." "It sure is," he said. Then grandfather put the lid on the jar and shook it up really good. "This jar is your mind right now," he said. "Angry thoughts bouncing around all over the place." "Now let's see what happens when we let your angry thoughts settle down," grandfather said, putting the mind jar right in front of me. "Just sit quietly and see what happens." I sat up real straight. Then I got to ring the gong. Bong! I sat watching all my angry thoughts swirl around like crazy in the jar. A few thoughts slowed down and sank to the bottom. Then a few more, and then a few more. It was so still I could hear my heart beating. It was so quiet, I could hear my breath going in and out, in and out. I felt a ray of golden sunshine coming through the window. It warmed my back, started to melt away the last bit of anger. Finally, grandfather rang the gong to end the meditation. He leaned over to whisper in my ear. "Okay," he said. "This part's important. Don't move until you can't hear the sound of the gong anymore." So I cocked my head and listened very carefully. Bong. The ringing got softer and softer and softer until I couldn't hear it at all. Grandfather smiled and held up the jar. "Well, look at this. All the sparkles have settled down," he said. my angry thoughts have too, I said. I mean, I guess if I think about it, I could get mad again. That's probably true, he said. But we have to work pretty hard. We had to work pretty hard to settle them down. Let's not stir them up again. And I laughed for the first time that day. Wow, that thing is cool, I said. Can I keep it? Sure, said Grandfather. He smiled and handed me the jar and the dish of sparkles. A few minutes each day helps keep Moody Cow away. I laughed again. Thanks, Grandfather. Can we do this again tomorrow? Of course. Let's try to do this together every day. Good advice. I went to my room and put the mind jar by my bed, just in case the three-eyed alien ever comes back. And now it's been 2 whole weeks, and I haven't had one Moody Cow day. But I've decided to keep the name anyway. I kind of like it. And if you can see, but he's crossing Peter off on his door and writing Moody Cow instead. That's my favorite part, actually. This is really when you understand, I think. The end. And there are actually directions for how to create your own Moody Cow jar in the back. So that wouldn't be the worst idea. So anyway, just bring that up because it's worth remembering, you know, that this practice, it has a very simple root to it, you know, and we are so complicated, you know, and so smart and looking for complicated solutions to our complicated problems. And notably, Grandfather did not help Peter sort of deconstruct his day or figure out how to, you know, solve his problems with his sister or have a long conversation about the contents of his mind, right? They just let it settle. Which is essentially what we're trying to do in Zazen. So I thought, for the rest of the talk, talk a little bit more about Fukan Sazengi, which we chanted this morning. If you weren't here a couple weeks ago, we started talking about Fukan Sazengi a couple of weeks ago. So I'll just give you a brief summary. Somehow I spent a whole talk in like the first paragraph. But that's how it goes. So this is Dogen's text about Zazen, and it was really kind of a mission statement, I realized, studying at this time. He wrote this pretty soon after he came back from his adventures in China and established his first very small monastery on the outskirts of Kyoto. And he wrote this, I think, to kind of clarify what he was trying to do for himself and for the others. And he pretty much stuck to this for the rest of his life in various ways. You know, exploring the subtleties and the nuances of the ways that we understand the world or don't. But essentially, his advice is like Grandfather Cow's. So the opening part, which we chanted this morning, does that sound familiar? You remember chanting this?
Yes.
It's a long time ago. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one, right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? So the opening is focused on the settled jar that we already have. And I was reflecting in the last talk, it's kind of a strange opening in a way from our conventional point of view, that if we were trying to sell meditation practice, we probably wouldn't start with this whole section about how, well, you're basically perfect already, and there's no need to practice. You know, we would probably instead explore the problems and we'd focus on the sparkles, right? You got all these sparkles, you need Zazen, this is really going to help you. But actually, Dogen's focused on the water. He's focused on the clarity. The sparkles, you can see, are so small. then we can feel the whole jar. Not to overuse the Mooney Cow metaphor too much. But to recognize, another way to look at this is to deeply recognize what's right with you. You know, so much is right with us. Just the fact that we're even alive, you know, is unbelievably right, you know, is unbelievably awakening already. You know, how could that even be, that we're alive and in this room together, even with our aches and pains and our this's and that's and our emotions and our sparkles, and yet, here we are. So that's how he opens it. But then there's a turning word right after that. So this is the part I want to focus on today, because this is where Sashin is so useful to us. Then he says, and yet. And yet. Which is essentially kind of where the whole of Buddhism is. It's in that and yet, and especially Zen. It's kind of like Esau's, that Japanese Buddhist poet Esau. Do you know Esau? 17th century, maybe? He has a famous poem that uses that same phrase, and Dogen's using the same characters, and yet. In Issa's case, you know, very settled practitioner, and must have been a lay practitioner because he had kids. And so his daughter dies young. And he supposedly wrote this poem, hopefully I can remember it, I didn't write this down. Supposedly wrote this poem like right after the funeral, you know, at the gravesite. Something like, this lotus world is a perfect lotus world, and yet, you know, and yet. And the Japanese culture maybe really appreciates that sense of beauty and sadness are together. You know, we want beauty and, like, good times, you know, yee-haw. So it's a little bit different sensibility. So Dogen also says, and yet, things are perfect. There's this clear jar, and yet. He says, if there's the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So anyway, here we are this morning in our version of the sort of perfect Zen monastic life. Did any likes or dislikes arise so far? Oh, really? And then the mind is lost in confusion. But he says it's a slight discrepancy. There's a slight sense of being off in some way. And here we're into preferences, right? Here into personality. Here we're into our sort of self-reference. What do I like? What do I dislike? Because you can't really have liking and disliking without an I, right? Otherwise it would just be sparkles, right? Just be dust. The I is what gives it weight, you know, and strength and power. And of course, when we're upset about something, not getting what we want or getting what we don't want, do we focus on that part of it? No. We focus on the object. We focus on the like or dislike, not on the I that's generating the whole thing. And this may, in Dogen's case, also be a reference to the famous poem of Senkan called Faith in Mind. We've talked about that before, which has this famous first line, right? The great way is not difficult. Just set aside picking and choosing. And so the Sashin container is sort of, in a way, an experimental lab, you know, for noticing picking and choosing and setting it aside, because if the container's strong, you don't have any choice, you know. The bell rang, you have to sit. They pass the bowl, you have to eat that, you know. Not what you wanted, this, you know. So it's a way of working with this very experientially and very directly. And in this phrase about the slightest discrepancy, there's so many, I'm going to sound really smarter than I am here, because there's so many great resources online. So I found online a resource by one of the famous English translators of Dogen, Mike Cross. He's a guy from the UK. And he created this website about Fukan Zazengi where he shows each character, and it's actually pictures from a text written in Dogen's hand, each character and what it means. And so you can see there's places where the English translation seems pretty close to what the characters are saying, and there's places where it's just really hard to sort of make that jump between a series of ideographs and English grammar and thinking. But anyway, the characters for this slight discrepancy are two characters. The first means a fine hair. Fine hair. And the second character means a hundredth. So that's how far off we are from the Great Way. Not very far. a hundredth of a fine hair. Not even a thick hair, a fine hair. So that's like good news and bad news, right? The good news is the slightest shift in this. You know, the slightest shift in this habitual, self-generated pattern of life where we're isolated and liking and disliking and separated and angry, the slightest shift in that is huge. And it's right back into the Buddha way. So that's the good news. But the bad news is, then you're going to be off again, right? The slightest shift. And, so one way to look at being human is we're always a hair's breadth off. And is that something we have to fix? Or is it just the nature of our living that we can work with and practice with? So it's not so clear. He's not saying, fix the discrepancy exactly either. He's recognizing this reality. And a good way to study this slight discrepancy is, there's many good ways, right? All strong emotions are good ways, but the one I think of is righteousness. When we think we're right, then we're not. That's the discrepancy. That's like what oozes out of that tiny little gap that's a thousandth of a fine hair's wide. Is this, I'm right, you're wrong. Then Dogen goes on to say, suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things, attaining the way and clarifying the mind, raising an aspiration to escalate the very sky. One is making the initial partial excursions about the frontiers, but is still somewhat deficient in the vital way of total emancipation. So that's a very dense paragraph. Let's read it again. Suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things, attaining the way and clarifying the mind. So this all sounds good, Clarifying, attaining, understanding. Raising an aspiration to escalate the very sky. So, we're really excited. We're feeling better. We're feeling in harmony with something. At that point, one is making the initial partial excursions about the frontiers, but is still somewhat deficient in the vital way of total emancipation. So some kind of pointer here to a few things. And the obvious one, of course, is pride, which naturally arises. But the other is the depth and endlessness of this journey of exploration. It's sort of both affirming of something. There is a sense here of you can understand something more clearly about your life. You can have a connection with wisdom. You can clarify the mind. You can be very expansive, like you're ready to escalate the very sky, kind of funny English expression. And yet, that's incomplete. That's partial. Please look again. Please humbly examine your understanding and let go. And one of the great things I've been thinking about, and we talked about this the other day too, what's great about chanting a text over and over again, whether you've studied it or talked about it or even thought about it, particularly outside of the service, is that some of the phrases just kind of get into your mind in some way, in some subconscious way, sort of enter the sort of storehouse of consciousness. And sometimes they pop up just when you need them. So you could chant this phrase about pride a million times, and, that's nice, yeah. But then at some point the conditions might be right for just to sort of leap forth, And you say, oh my gosh, I was feeling so right and so good about Dharma. Suppose one gets pride of understanding, but it just all comes, So that's a wonderful aspect of our liturgical practice. And actually, this particular phrase was very important to me last summer. It came very strongly to mind, the whole thing, It's like, is that thing about pride? No, it's like the whole thing just started cycling through my mind. And it's very helpful. Because, and all of this is not fodder for beating ourselves up. Oh, we're never going to be good enough. Dogen says so, We're always going to be a little bit off. We're going to be pride. We're going to be partial. Whoa. I quit now. You know, that's not at all what he's doing. He's just trying to encourage us to be humble and keep practicing. So I really appreciate this phrase, but actually I was reading a talk that Norman Fisher gave on Fukan Zazenki, and he's critical of this phrase. So I want to read you what he says. You get another point of view. Norman said about this particular phrase, "I think that this translation, in my opinion, in my understanding of the text, is a little bit misleading, because our translator didn't entirely appreciate Dogen's point here. Using words like pride of understanding and inflates one's enlightenment makes it sound as if this is somebody whose enlightenment is imperfect and not quite right. This makes it sound like a tainted experience of enlightenment. But I don't think Dogen means that. The way I would translate it is that I would take those words out, and I would say, suppose one gains understanding and enlightenment and sees the wisdom that runs through all things and attains the way and clarifies the mind and raising an aspiration that goes up to the skies. Suppose that happens. Suppose our fantasies about how we're going to become Buddhas, our fantasies about how we're going to become Buddhas, and everything all comes true. Suppose at the end of this very retreat, we all walk out and say, I'm enlightened. It's unbelievable. This is great. It happened. But wouldn't that be great? So Norman's bringing up one side of this, which is important to bring up too. That any sort of conception we have of practice is limited by its conceptual nature. And the sense that we have that we're somehow broken and incomplete and there's some other enlightenment over there is a very sort of rigid, dualistic notion. And this was really kind of the theme that Dogen explored all his life. How can it be that there's some sense of complete awakening, Buddha nature, things are just as they are, just right. How can that be true? And at the same time, how can it be true that we are prideful, we are confused, we are upset, we are angry, we are lashing out? You know, how can these two things coexist? And so we have to look at both of them. In this particular passage, Norman's more interested in the sort of emptiness side of this, the complete side of this. There's no enlightenment for you to get. There's nothing for you to attain. And the minute you think so, you're putting yourself on a little hamster wheel. You're just making this into another project. And you're never going to get to the end of that. But actually, I looked at the character-by-character translation, and Norman's wish is kind of wishful thinking, actually, because Dogen very clearly has the characters for pride, understanding, and enlightenment in there. So I have to take my teacher to task a little bit, you know. Sometimes we want the text to say what we want it to say. And, you know, that's fine too. There's no right and wrong teaching here. It's just each of us trying to bring up our understanding of how are things really. How do we work with this life the way it actually is? So there's another translation, a good recent translation, that said, these are reliable translators, Kazuaki Tanahashi and Peter Levitt. They translated this passage, "You could be proud of your understanding and have abundant realization, or acquire outstanding wisdom and attain the way by clarifying the mind. Still, if you're wandering about in your head, you miss the vital path of letting your body leap." So that's interesting. Very different. You could be proud of your understanding, have abundant realization, so that's similar, or acquire outstanding wisdom and attain the way by clarifying the mind. Still, if you're only wandering about in your head, you may miss the vital path of letting your body leap. And so the actual characters do talk about the body very directly. So it's an important part to bring up. That Dogen from the beginning was saying, this is an embodied practice. And that's really an easy one for us to miss or forget and have to rediscover and relearn. That this is not a mental exercise. Our self-concept is so embedded in thinking. It's so easy for us to think, okay, I just need better thoughts. If I could just outthink my thinking and think about my problems in a better way, I'd be happier, whatever it is we want. But actually, the practice is not a thought practice. Thoughts are just one aspect of experience, one aspect of reality. And it might be time for us to take some of our identification and energy to withdraw that from the realm of thought, to not give thought so much chutzpah in our life. And what are the obvious alternatives? Body, breath, sensations. And the Buddhists didn't really talk about emotions as separate from thinking, but I think it's helpful for us to think about emotion kind of as a tone, as a feeling. So not the contents of why we're this way, or why we're that way, or why she should have done it this way, or why they shouldn't have served us yogurt, don't they know I'm non-dairy? You know, but the actual feeling. Oh, irritation. You know, oh, stomach is tight. Oh, there's some feeling. The whole body, that I can't even put a word on. Because once you put a word on it, you're already a little bit in the realm of thought. So Dogen here in our text, what time are we supposed to stop? On the schedule?
11:40.
Okay, thank you. So Dogen right away emphasizing in this text from the very beginning that pride and that disconnection, that possible sort of misuse in a way of understanding may have to do with leaving your body, with forgetting your body. Please return to the body. And he had a famous phrase. His sort of phrase for awakening was dropping away body and mind. Dropping away body and mind. So body and mind in some way in harmony and in some way just released from the conceptual world completely. And another thing in this little passage is the character ki is there, like in Aikido, the character for energy. So Dogen recommending that we bring up some energy in our practice. It requires effort. And this whole passage about pride and understanding and how are you working with this, in a way it has a sort of an element of just be alert, you know, be awake. And it makes me think, don't fool yourself into thinking you are somebody who can possess something or who doesn't possess something, which is kind of the side Norman's bringing up. Don't think you're not enlightened, and don't think you are enlightened. And it made me think of a wonderful koan, so just mention a koan as an aside. And who knows if Dogen was trying to reference this or not. Dogen's writing, the other interesting thing about Dogen's writing is it's just outrageously dense with references, most of which we'll probably never know, you know. Somehow Dogen, like, he was, you know, in addition to having such a deep feeling for practice, you know, embodied practice, and this sort of two-sided coin of the perfection of our life and the need to practice, you know. In addition to that, the guy was a real brainiac, you know. And somehow he went to China for around 3 years, we don't know exactly how long he was in China, and just absorbed, like, this enormous Chinese Buddhist canon. And the Chinese Buddhist canon itself completely absorbed thousands of years of Chinese literary history, and somehow Dogen just sucked that up. I don't know how he did it, you know. He brought back, you know, there's different, we don't really know what he brought back, but he certainly brought back some texts, but you know, the level of stuff that he references in Chinese Chan and Chinese literary history is just unbelievable. You know, now we have to study for decades just to kind of get a sense of what he's talking about. Anyway, so who knows who he's referencing this story, but it's a good story. Every day, Master Ruyuan, some of these names are hard, every day Master Ruyuan would call to himself, "Master! Master!" And every day he would respond, "Yes?" And then he would say, "Be awake, be alert." "Yes." "From now on, don't be fooled by anything." "Okay, I won't be." So every day, this was his daily practice, to call to himself, to call himself forth, you know. You know, "Master, Master," you could use your own name, you know, "Tim, Tim." And answer yourself, "Yes?" And you can see the value of that right away, right? I mean, there's a way that you're not home sometimes, right? So show up. Show up in your life. Call yourself and knock on your own door. Show up in your life. Yes? And remind yourself. Be awake. Be alert. You know, notice. What's happening now? What are you feeling now? Yes, I'll be alert. And remind yourself, don't be fooled. So just like Moody Cow, you know, don't be fooled by your violent sparkles. Don't be fooled by your pride of understanding. Don't be fooled by thinking you're broken in some way. Okay, I won't be. Repeat. So Dogen goes on. Need I mention the Buddha, who was possessed of inborn knowledge? The influence of his 6 years of upright sitting is noticeable still. Or Bodhidharma's transmission of the mind seal. The fame of his 9 years of well sitting is celebrated to this day. Now to us this reads like examples, encouraging us to sort of do something. You know, need I mention, you know, such and so example? But I don't think Dogen meant this as examples. And of course, if we see them as examples right away, we don't quite measure up, right? Actually, I think what he's doing is reminding us of ancestors. And these are the two most important ancestors in our mytho-poetic Zen world, Buddha and Bodhidharma. And in the very first paragraph, which I got into last time, there was a reference to another ancestor, Huineng, also important. So last summer, some of us got to go to Japan. Norman and some of us went to Japan. And actually, Norman didn't want us to go there to like learn, you know, ceremonies or how to do it right or anything like that, or to learn. He didn't really care if we learned any Japanese. He wanted us to go to Japan to sort of have some feeling, some experiential sense of the importance there in the practice of ancestors. Maybe one day we'll organize another trip, a Bellingham Northwest trip. Because I really like for you to have this experience too. If, you know, who knows what you'll experience. But we did, actually. We did have some small experience of something that's really baked into the culture and lived day by day in Japan and probably throughout Asia. The sense of ancestors not being in the past and not being some distant thing that we're independent of and now asserting ourselves and our independence and the primacy of our generation. But more of a sense of our work being to uphold and honor the ancestors, and that our honor and our support being to be in part of a sort of matrix. And you know, they know historically that these people are long dead, if they ever lived at all. But at the same time, there's a feeling that's beyond that. And this exists actually here, too, in the native cultures that lived here for so many thousands of years. Jeff and Kate hangs around there too, you know, has some sense of this. And often we bring up ancestors, he always has the same sort of sense of it. And if you go, you can easily access this actually through him. They have a sweat lodge every Thursday night. And during the sweat lodge, they say this phrase over and over again, all my relations are thinking about the ancestors. And they have some feeling that the spot of dirt they're sitting on has had presence from their ancestors, you know, for thousands of years. So it's the same in Asia, and it's the same with your birth family ancestors and your spiritual ancestors, that they're really right here with you. And that without this sense of ancestors, there really is no practice there. There's a sense of, a deep sense of connection. And so I think little by little, you know, it's going to take us some hundreds of years. And this generation will just kind of get the ball rolling, maybe. We'll start to have that feeling in our practice that it's not about me and now, which is how we think, right? We have to admit. We think it's about me and now. So the sense here of bringing up Buddha and Bodhidharma is, remember, this is much, much bigger than that. Transcends time, transcends the personal, transcends this idea that you think you're separate. And one textual note that's really interesting, I'm grateful to Mike Cross for this, where the characters he used for Buddha in this passage, He used the usual two characters for Shakyamuni, which means sage of the Shakya clan, which is one of the, they have lots of names for Buddha, one of the names of Buddha. But then he's had two more characters for Roshi, you know, like old teacher, so an honorific in Japan. But he didn't use the usual characters for Roshi. He used the usual Ro, meaning old or, you know, venerable. But then the Shi, instead of the character for a teacher or a person, an adult person, used the character for child. It's a character for child. So this is relevant to our Buddha's birthday ceremony. So he said, sage of the Shakyas, venerable child. Venerable child. So there's a sense here of birth and renewal happening all the time. So these are not old dead guys, right? They're being born now on this breath, you know, on this moment. So isn't that cool? And it's also an example of the layers of meaning that we would be experiencing or being confused by if we were reading this in with Chinese characters, you know. And we say, wait a minute, that's not the usual. And then you have to go look it up and figure it out. And then every time you chant that, you say, oh. It's... And of course, we just say, need I mention the Buddha? We don't know any of these layers that are happening underneath that. But now you do. You know, the sense of old and new. This dichotomy that we hold, because we are sort of caught in the middle of an idea of birth and death, right? First you're born, that's great, fantastic. Hopefully little Arya will be here this afternoon and we can say, oh yes, wonderful, you know. So sweet, so cute. And then you get old and kind of unpleasant and, you know. And then you die, it's terrible, you know. And actually just this morning I checked my messages and my grandmother, who's 92 this year, had another fall and she actually is one of my inspirations, one of the reasons I came to practice. She was very interested. She kind of grew up a New England Deb, but she got very interested in spirituality and yoga and was kind of an oddball in her family. And so I grew up hearing stories of her in the background talking about miracle healers in Brazil and all these experiences she had. And she taught yoga well into her 70s. But now somehow her practice didn't really prepare her for her body failing and being in her 90s. And she's very angry and upset, and she wouldn't let this has happened. I almost thought that it had been a mistake, and this email from last year had been sent again, because it's the exact same thing that happened. She went to the bathroom, but she didn't want her helper person to come in with her. You know, we don't, privacy. And she fell getting off of the toilet. That time she broke her wrist, this time she injured her leg in some way. So we're sort of caught in this birth and death in our culture. So it's hard for us to age gracefully. And here he's saying the Buddha is sort of that whole wheel and beyond that wheel at the same time. So need I mention the Buddha kind of means all of these things. All of these things at once. Okay, it's almost time to stop. Maybe just one more section. Since this was the case with the saints of old, how can we today dispense with negotiation of the way? You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. This is really good. This is very liberating if we let it be. You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. So we have a sense of reaching for something or pushing away, right? Reaching and pushing away. And so this is an interesting sort of counterpoint to that tendency. Let go of your understanding. Let go of words and concepts. And then this last phrase is very important to Dogen. Learn the backward step that turns. So there's some sense of turning something around and some sense of light. And the light illuminates from within. So that's just something to kind of, I won't say much more about that. That's something for all of us to practice with. And besides, what I'm going to give you an intellectual understanding about not releasing yourself from intellectual understanding, great, you know. So we're not after some intellectual understanding of this teaching, you know. But what is this backward step? You know, we can explore that experientially in Zazen as we return to the breath. Return to the body, and especially Edie gave us some nice instructions about the walking meditation this morning. What is this step? What is this? in this inward light? You know, is this something we can make happen? Is this something we're getting out of the way of and it's just happening naturally? Or is it just something that is beyond anything we could talk about? So he's bringing up a lot of questions. So just one note about the afternoon, and then we'll stop, have a little bit more zazen, and then another meal. Bob is valiantly down there making lunch for us. We're always kind of working with silence. You know, silence is an important ingredient in this style of practice, and we have like a lot of meetings to talk about silence, believe you me. So the sort of formal way of doing sesshin is, you know, silence, period, more or less. But we've thought of different ways to sort of adapt things so it's workable for us and for people coming and going. And also for the fact that we are not living together in a monastic context in which during the daily routine there would be periods of zazen, but also periods of hanging around and having time to talk to each other and get to know each other in the conventional way as well as in sort of the spiritual way. You know, some of us coming from Seattle, wonderful, Ewan and Marjorie could come up, that we don't get to talk to very often. And so what we decided is for our one-day sesshin to have the dinners be informal. And so we can wander off to some local restaurant and have dinner together if you choose to. But to still honor this possibility of silence all day, and so what you can do is you can just stay here in the building and there's always enough leftovers downstairs to come up with a meal. It always works out. There'll be some extra soup or something. We have nuts. And, you know, so you could easily just stay here and be quiet. And so we would have during the dinner break, the building stays quiet, so we don't chat in the building. And you could even go off to have dinner on your own. That'd be wonderful, you know. How often do you get to have dinner by yourself in a restaurant, you know, or go to the co-op and get something? Or you could join up with the group of us, or it's such a nice, small, intimate retreat this time. We could all fit around a table, you know, the whole sesshin. So if you want to, we can do that. So that's how we're going to do dinners during our sesshins in town, you know, one day and 3 day and so on. And it also gives our knees a little bit of a break. And I have to admit, I was an advocate for 3 oryoki meals, but I was soundly overruled. So, but maybe some other time, you know, other places, you can experience that continuity of practicing just all day, all the meals are oryoki, everything, you know. And the Loon Lake retreat that they do in November in BC, they have all 3 meals oryoki, although they sit at a table, so your knees, I guess, get a break there. But, you know, you can go to monasteries and other centers. So that's one thing. So that's an unusual pattern, and then the first time we're doing it, we have an exception to it. Today, and the reason why we're having an exception to that usual pattern today is because today we're going to have a Buddhist birthday celebration at 3:30 in the afternoon, and people from the Sangha and the general community are invited, and, you know, it's a little bit of last-minute invitation. I don't know how many will come, but some people will come, and including, we hope, children. And so after the ceremony, we decided we would just have an informal tea time and hang around, and they'll be in the building, I guess, because it's not so great weather. So I guess if you want to really have a strong silence practice, you could just go on a walk during that time. It's beautiful to go on a walk. So we'll have a half-hour break after the Buddha's birthday and just hang around, and maybe there'll be some cookies or some cake, we hope. Maybe some birthday cake will appear. We don't know. And some tea, you know. And so anyway, that'll be an exception to the new rule, which already has an exception in it, so I hope that's clear as mud. So please cease practice based on intellectual understanding and just go along for the rest of the day. Quiet when it's quiet. Someone initiates a conversation and have a nice conversation. Okay, but anyway, thank you very much. It's really, you know, my job is just to provide a little entertainment for 50 minutes. Now it's back to work. But it's a non-work work, right? The minute you make it work, you have suffering. You have pain. So your body will let you know, and your mind. It's a releasing from work kind of work. We have enough projects. It's that downshifting, slowing down. Hearing the sounds around us, feeling the breath, noticing those wonderful likes and dislikes as they arise and watching them go again, just returning again. So that's really the opportunity and the reason why we would practice all day. It's not to, like, become spiritual athletes or, you know, open up our hips or something like that. It's to have that possibility. of the hair's breadth deviation and returning. Deviation and returning. Which takes time. It really takes time. And it is absolutely an experiential process. Like he's saying. That's what he means by cease practice based on intellectual understanding. It's useful to think about these things a little and to have some conceptual frame so that it makes sense so you'd show up, but then let it go. It's not something we can think ourselves into. It's something that our body and mind just learn little by little on their own.